I'm the coordinator, along with Nkenji Touré, of the International Council of African Women. Come on forward, Nkenji, don't hide in the back. Okay, and I also want to apologize for the air conditioning system not being on. Is that going to be turned on? It is going to be turned on. The holdup is that the entire university air conditioning system is on one computerized network, and it takes a special technician to come in and figure out which of the programs on this network affects this particular building, which makes a lot of sense when you might want to run air conditioning in only one building at a time as opposed to campus-wide. But I can only talk about Howard so badly because it's my alma mater. So I have real great memories here and some real interesting ones. I think what we've done this morning is come together to share some very important aspects of sisterhood. We're learning to anticipate where our strength will be needed in the struggle to end the oppression of women of color, and in particular, women of African descent. So this conference, African Women Rising, is appropriately named because we feel that African women are rising. African women are getting together, African women are becoming organized, and this is reflected in the whole growth of the women of color movement. I'm going to start with a little brief history of ICON, and then we'll get into the program. And I hope everybody has their conference packet, right? Because this is a working session, and you're going to use every one of those documents you've been handed. We put them on that colored paper to distract you from how much reading material that actually is. So, you know, tell them you've been to a rainbow conference or something like that if somebody asked you why you got all these different colored papers. ICAW, the International Council of African Women, was founded in 1982. Basically, we think of ourselves as a coalition in miniature, kind of miniature now because not even all of our members are here yet. A lot of them will be here this afternoon. But coalition in miniature is the way we describe ourselves because we are women who belong to a lot of different political organizations who sometimes work in organizations that don't work well together. So we've decided that we can come together in spite of these political differences amongst our organizations and do common work together as women of African descent. So that's why I call it a coalition in miniature. It's a miniature coalition because we haven't asked the leaderships of either of any of our organizations for permission to come together and work. We also, I think, are characterized by the fact, and Nkenji would attest to this, that we're all community workers. No one in ICAW sits in some ivory tower strategizing on how to liberate people of African descent. We're out there in the community on a daily basis. So our perspective on what needs to be done comes from our experience actually out there on the streets. We are not so much policy makers as action-oriented people that help the policy makers make policy. And we also decided to focus on international issues. It's very important that what's happening on an international level be brought back home to women in the States. For far too long, women at the grassroots level have been totally divorced from the international scene. Why? Because we didn't have the money to travel. Two, because the women who were doing the traveling were not bringing the resources back home and sharing them with the community. And three, because we have to be re-educated to understand the connectedness between our struggle and what's happening to our sisters in South Africa, for example. This is our fourth conference. 1983, we had a conference called Black Women and the Black Liberation Struggle, and that was really interesting. We brought together women from the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, the Black United Front, all to give a critique on what it was like to be an activist black woman in the 60s and 70s. We had that first conference in 83. In 84, we had another conference focusing this time not on the black liberation movement, but on the U.S. women's movement. We called it the poverty gap of the U.S. women's movement. I think a lot of you may remember that conference. It was probably our biggest to date. I think we had like 60 speakers, 27 workshops, the whole elaborate bit. That conference succeeded in identifying what were the major reasons why women of color were not in the U.S. women's movement, and what women of color needed to do about that. We came away from that conference in 1984 determined to build a women of color movement, because that's obviously where we need to go without sitting on that point too long. In 1985, we put together a summit of women of color who were going to Nairobi, who came together right here in the same room, as a matter of fact, to put together a national plan of action that women of color carried to the Nairobi conference, because we wanted to get some policy agreements on this side of the ocean and not play out our fights on that side of the ocean. And so we included in that plan of action some real serious issues. For example, we talked about the New World Information Order, the New World Economic Order. We talked about a very sensitive issue that's splitting the black community, lesbianism. We talked about generational problems, how the leadership of the movement is not being passed from generation to generation. So you have this whole core of people who are, you know, growing a little older, and then you have this young core of people who aren't fully integrated. We talked about things like that in our plan of action. So in 86, we're talking about African women rising, because when you put all of this together, this means that black women are coming into their own, black women are organized, and I'd like to give a little example of why I think we're organized. In 75, I had the task of putting together a mailing list for women of color organizations in the U.S., and I was quite proud, I mean grassroots too, and I was quite proud when I got up to 125 names on that list in 1975, because that was the best we could do. That's where we were. My 1986 Women of Color list has more than 900 names on it, 900 women of color organizations around the country. That's an incredible 10-year growth. We need to attest to that growth. We need to know about that growth, and we need to brag about that growth, because no other movement is moving at that fast a pace. Why do you have a conference on international issues? There's been a lot of developments taking place in the world that demands the attention of women of color. In fact, I think our lives are at stake. I think we don't need to rehash out how bad our lives are. I mean, we got jobs and we're underpaid. We have housing and we get rats and roaches for free. You know, we have children and we worry about the quality of their education, whether or not they're going to finish it, are they going to get pregnant before they get finished, or are they going to become a father before they, and encourage them to drop out. I mean, I ain't got to rehash out those problems. I think, though, that we need to understand that when Reagan gets defeated, and I enjoyed this past week legislatively, Reagan got defeated on the South African sanctions vote, and I mean, that is the strength of the power. But at the same time Reagan got defeated, he gave $100 million to the Contras in Nicaragua. That's a defeat for us, and we need to understand the connectedness of our struggle to that struggle so that we understand that that's a defeat for us. He's giving aid to UNITA to overturn the government of Angola. Why? Because the government won't dance to his tune. But at the same time, he's denying aid to Zimbabwe because the deputy ambassador had the nerve to speak the truth to President Carter while he was there. So they're playing games with our lives, and we need to be serious about these kinds of actions. And then right here, we got these right-wing attacks. We have attacks on reproductive rights, violence at abortion clinics that mostly affects black women who have to use these public services. We've got a black woman in 1986, June 1986, was lynched in California. What was this, 3 months ago? You know? So we have violence here in our lives. We have violence connecting us to the women of South Africa. But in response to this, we're getting organized. Now let's look at the packets in detail. Each country that we'll be reporting on today has a blurb sheet in it in your packet, because this is a conference about learning and sharing. We hope to share some things with you, and we hope to learn some things from you, and hope the process is continuous. I want to start off by pointing out the significant UN documents in your packet. One of the things that we found out during our Nairobi organizing that was quite often, information was not shared, it was not widely disseminated, and it was not made available. A very important meeting at the UN took place this last May of African NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who came to the UN to stress how they needed support from what they call northern and international NGOs, meaning us. Women in the West. We have the full report from that meeting. It's the first white, large white thing in your packet. Now, I'll be getting back to this much later on in the discussion when we talk about the 1990 conference, the recommendations that came out of this report. But a lot of this conference is focused around the recommendations in this report, because the dialogue has taken place between us, sisters and sisters around the world. These are their recommendations to us, and we're going to make sure that we pay close attention to them, because we need to follow up on this new round of dialogue. Other UN documents in the report, there's a very important Association of African Women for Research and Development. It's a very important organization on the continent. They have a one-page summary of the UN Special General Assembly meeting. I hope everybody sees this. These are things that we're going to ask you to at least glance over during your lunch break, because after lunch we're going to be talking about significant developments in these two reports I just pointed out to you. I know most of you probably say, when are we going to stop talking about Nairobi? Unfortunately, I have to be the bearer of bad news and say never. We're never going to stop talking about Nairobi, because Nairobi was very much a beginning for women of African descent. It catalyzed what I call the International African Women's Movement. When we came there in unprecedented numbers, we left there with a determination to continue this process, and so we're probably never going to stop talking about our birth, because I see Nairobi as the conference, as the birth of our movement. In your packet is another view on the Nairobi conference written by an African woman. Okay, should I pull it out for show and tell, or? It's on an orange sheet. Okay, the UN Women's Decade. Okay. Handouts on Kenya and Tanzania are also in your packets. We're not going to have formal presentations on Kenya and Tanzania. We did a lot of those over the past year and during our Nairobi report back. We're going to discuss Kenya and Tanzania some more during the slideshow. But we want to point out one particular article that was really like historic. There's a green article called The Kenyan Woman, A Decade of Oppression. We were given this article in Nairobi by some exiled Kenyans, before we got to Nairobi actually, by some exiled Kenyans. We made 200 copies of this article and attempted to distribute it in Nairobi. Every time we put these articles out in a public space, the police attempted to confiscate them, the Kenyan police, because this article details the level of oppression that was taking place in Kenya during the conference. How they arrested all the prostitutes off the street, put many men and women in jail. It talked about the political prisoners in Kenyan society that we don't hear about. The lines were so long of Kenyans wanting to read this article, you would have thought we were giving out free money, because they don't get this kind of information. And so we want you to pay particular attention, because a lot of people are going to be talking about the Nairobi conference, but this is Kenyans talking about Nairobi before and after the conference. Then we have what I call a real gem. We've put together a list of black women's organizations around the world: Vietnam, Brazil, Guyana, Puerto Rico, Mexico, you name it, where we could find a black women's organization, we put it together on our international networking list. It was quite a shock to discover a Vietnamese Afro-Asian group, for example. And Guyana, where else we've got? St. Croix, the Virgin Islands, Philippines, New Caledonia, so that you can get in touch with the Kanak struggle there. All of these are on this important resource. I think if you were to leave the whole packet and walk away just with this, you've gotten a very important resource. Then we have a yellow discussion paper on the 1990 conference. A lot of you are saying, well, what in the world is the 1990 conference? The African women who met in Arusha in 1984 to prepare for Nairobi decided that there should be a world conference for women of African descent to be held no later than the year 1990. Tentatively, that conference is scheduled for Zimbabwe. This is our discussion paper on the conference. What are some of the issues raised? Who's going to be invited? Who's gonna sponsor it? You know, what role can we play? And we're gonna have a particular portion of the agenda that deals with the 1990 conference in particular. Okay, and the last thing I wanna draw your attention to is that the next major ICOT tour for the summer of next year is going to be to Jamaica. And I hope every one of you tries to go with us to Jamaica. We're gonna spend the entire month of August in Jamaica. The main impetus for our going is that the island as a whole is planning an island-wide celebration of the centennial of the birth of Marcus Garvey. He'll be 100 years old next August 17, 1987. And so we are sponsoring a women's tour to attend the centennial celebrations of Marcus Garvey's birth. At the same time, we're gonna go to Sunsplash and do a little bit of partying. Y'all know about Sunsplash, the big reggae concert that they have down there. That's about the same time. And we've also scheduled a tour of Jamaican women's groups to round off our trip. So if you can, schedule your whole vacation for next August, okay? And come visit Jamaica with us. So if you can only take a portion of it, still come, because I think just going to the centennial and visiting the Kenyan of the Jamaican women's groups will make the trip worth it. And it's what, great. And it's what we call, I almost say a poor person's trip, because most of us cannot afford to go to Africa at a moment's notice. But we can work out packages to go to Jamaica that make it affordable for almost anybody. And you can join us in international travel. Now I've got a few more detail type things, and then I'll go through. As you can see from your program, which should have been the first thing on the left-hand side of your packet, we have two panels, three workshops, and lots of discussion time. So you will get a chance to ask your questions and everything else. Lunch spots are one block away, all up and down the Georgia Avenue corridor, and instructions and directions for getting to them are posted outside. If you have children in child care, you should pick up your children for lunch, take them to lunch. We will have snacks and games and toys available for them in the meantime. We are taping this entire program, and you can purchase tapes from us after the conference. And I should also tell you that a free ICOM membership comes along with your conference registration for those of you who are not already ICOM members. So you will be getting from now on, regular copies of our newsletter, our conference announcements, and everything. You won't have to sign up and begin that. And I will ask if there's any conference questions before I bring up our hosts for the day. Any conference-related questions? Y'all discovered where the ladies' room is? Okay. Okay, I'd like to bring up Byron Harris, who's with the Howard University Student Association and has really, really worked to make this conference a success. And I should also mention that our keynote speaker is here right now. Come on up, Matt.
Thank you, Sister Rose. I am overjoyed to be here this morning. I thoroughly believe in African women rising because I'm an African man who's hopefully on the rise also. I would like to first of all welcome you on behalf of the Howard University Student Association. I work in the capacity of the Community Action Director with that organization. When I first heard of the African Women Rising Conference, I'm not a normal, I say average male when it comes to dealing with my, I call them my sisters. I think it's also fitting that the conference be held at Howard since the president of the student body is a young lady, and also the vice president is a young lady. So we have women at the top. And to, I guess, digress on that particular topic, it is befitting because this year, or this summer, I should say, Howard University students proved that sexism is dying on our campus. And I take great pride in saying that. we had, it was somewhat of a situation which still I think about and perplexes me, because we had Sister Ona Austin running for office and her running mate, Yvonne Brooks, and several of our African brothers supported them. And throughout the campaign, we would have remarks from, you know, sisters and brothers, why are y'all supporting those women? You know, and it was just I guess it illustrated their ignorance and what we were trying to say and what we were trying to do. It boils down to this. If you have a program and it is a progressive program and it is one that will help the masses of people, then I support you. That is why I supported those two sisters. Therefore, I guess in a nutshell, as men of African descent, we must support women of African descent. Because in any society, any civilization, women are the foundation of those societies and civilizations. The way, and throughout, this is, I guess hopefully this is not subjective, because I've read a lot of research and read a lot of books, done a lot of research and read a lot of books on this topic. And it seems through all these situations, when civilizations start to degenerate and fall to pieces, it seems that somehow it was connected to the subjugation, the humiliation of the women. And that's why I say that if African women rise, then African men cannot help but rise. Also, I would like to state also that I had the fortune of meeting with another great and powerful sister in the struggle, Sister Ella Collins, this summer. We had her here for our annual community day. And by looking at her, seeing what type of woman she was, I realized why Malcolm X was the man he was, because he had a sister who taught him, who instructed him in how to deal with this system that we live in. And she told us several things, but one thing that sticks in my mind that she, I guess, spoke on, even at the Community Day event in her hotel room, is that for us as a people in America, black people, people of African descent, I don't like the word black because black is just a color, but people of African descent, for us to bring ourselves from the situation that we are presently in, it will take the effort, the combined effort, of African men and African women. And, you know, I was like, well, I thought, you know, men's supposed to be doing et cetera, et cetera. But she said no. She said no that, you know, I had to deal with my chauvinism also. And I must be frank that to say that to live in this society, every man has conflicts within himself. And that is just, I guess, given. But I've learned a lot when she said that we must work together. And I was saying, well, I thought, you know, the black male is supposed to lead the movement, and et cetera, we supposed to. She said, no. She said, if you look at South Africa, look at the situation in South Africa. Who do you see in the forefront of the movement? Well, I said, well, I see African women. She said, that's where it starts. And in all this, I was drawn to do research about this. And this is why I say African women, or women in general, are the foundation. Because you are the ones who create civilization. make society livable, teach children their culture. You are the ones on which civilizations are found. On your shoulders, we all stand. So as Sister Ella was telling me, that if we as African males cannot respect our own, then we must put ourselves aside and work out our conflicts, for then when we come together, we will not compound the pressure, the oppressive pressures that are on black women in this country with sexism and racism, because it is a dual battle for you. You have a greater battle than I have. I only have to deal with one thing, and you have to deal with two things.
Yep. So,
capitalism also, yes, true. So I might not be here all day, but I'm going to try to stay long enough to learn more. As I say, that Howard is a fitting place for a conference of such. I hope we can go over to the International Day and get some more of the sisters and brothers to come over, and hopefully we can all learn together. At this time, I turn it back over to Sister Ross. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. One of the reasons we chose to have this conference at Howard, as Brother Byron said, Howard University became the first American college to elect an all-female student government. And we think that that's historic. That's wonderful. And the whole election did bring out a lot of the question of sexism on the Howard University campus. What are these attitudes like? We look so colorful when we get together. We do. Without a lot of further ado, I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker, who really got out of her sick bed to be with us this morning. By all rights, Decima Williams should still be in bed because she has a severe cold, but she is with us today. She burns a lot of lights for women here in the Washington area. We're very privileged that she lives here because she's not only an example, but she's a prophet. She's also a woman who is able to summarize why we're all involved in this struggle, why we end up giving our lives to this struggle, why I'm not watching my son march in the marching band this morning, and why I'm here. She's presently in law school at American University and is an organizer of the Caribbean Student Association of American University. And I believe she has an announcement about a fundraiser that the Caribbean Student Association is having this evening for people who would like to attend. She's the former ambassador to the United States from the government of Grenada during the government of Maurice Bishop and a representative of the New Jewel Movement under Maurice Bishop. I'd like you to all join me in welcoming Decima Williams.
Not 45 minutes. Morning, sisters and brothers. And thank you very much, Loretta, for this introduction, which I would like to correct. I have a cold, but no, I am not studying law. I am studying international relations at American University. I want to thank the ICA, International Council of African Women, for convening this conference. It is not the first you have had, as far as I am aware, but it is the first that is being held after major events concerning women have been occurring. And I speak, of course, of the close of the decade for women. I speak of the recently concluded non-aligned movement meeting in Harare, and I speak of the general political and military condition in the Caribbean region, which I will speak a little bit. So this is, for me in particular, a very useful moment. Please excuse me, I should say this off the record. I couldn't find my glasses, and when I don't have my glasses, I can't think. So although I have a speech, I think I left it in school yesterday. We had a big program there. Sisters, what we are gathered here to do today, as I understand it, is to reorganize our thrust for the upcoming period, which comes out of the different events that I have just mentioned. And I think it is important that those of us who have been actively involved in these diverse international gatherings that affect women and that have had women's concern on the agenda should in fact try to coordinate our programs, our strategies for continued work. It is against this background then that I'd like to lay a contextual framework for what we are about to engage in. Because in a sense, we do not have the very definitive umbrella of the United Nations Decade for Women, though I know that the structure not only continues, but that the structure has left many decentralized pieces of national and regional organs in place, so that whether it is sisters in East Timor, or sisters building a new society in Nicaragua, or the PLO women, or the sisters in the whole of Southern Africa fighting under apartheid, that all these diverse geographic and in many cases cultural expressions of women continue to receive and were strengthened by the decade and what we did together. So that as that continues, it is fitting for us still to find a framework that the work can not just continue in a very diverse way, but that it can lead to even higher levels of success, such as we have seen in the last 10 years. With that in mind, I thought it might be appropriate for us here in the United States, and certainly in Washington, to orient our perspective about the historic moment in which we are living. And I begin by reminding us of the obvious, that in fact the slave history and the colonial society out of which we emerged, and I tell my students at American University that I have a very unique distinction, which is I came from a colony. I now live in a country that is colonized, effectively colonized by a foreign power. And I live in the District of Columbia, which is still a colony. So that in many ways, the issue of colonialism is not that removed from our daily lives. And more importantly, the slave legacy is alive and well. It has framed our attitudes. It has framed our values. It has framed the level at which women were able to move forward. It has, in fact, given us a framework of underdevelopment, a framework of insecurity, a framework, most of all, of the necessity to regain our heritage. Of course, in the 1960s, the advent of independence was heralded in vast many areas of the world. And one of the for women especially, independence brought really flags and ceremonies and new bombastic political leaders, many of whom were not women, many of whom were more concerned with what Frantz Fanon has called being the mimic men, or is it Naipaul, who has referred to the new leadership in the 60s as mimic men. And that's exactly what they were, mimic of the colonial past and mainly men. So that during that period, we ourselves were not actively involved in fashioning our own future. Of course, today, an unprecedented crisis of global proportions has engulfed the entire international community. And this is manifested in economic, political, and other forms. For us women, we know that because we are experiencing many different forms of the crisis, which I'll discuss in a minute. But how did we get to that crisis? And I contend that the 1980s is really a product of the post-World War II period, the 1945 Bretton Woods arrangement, in which the European balance of power gave way to the new balance of power in which the United States became the dominant force militarily, politically, economically, and for all practical purposes, and this is documented in the literature, became the new hegemon, certainly on a global scale, administering as far away as Guam and so on, but hegemonic especially within the Americas. Out of that 1945 post-World War II period, we had the institutions of the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, the GATT, General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, UNCTAD, and of course, the now in the United States infamous UNESCO. What was important for us is despite that change in the balance of power in the 1940s, most of Africa and the Caribbean continued until, when was it, 1957, with the formal independence of Ghana. And the process of independence, in fact, continues today. I think, according to my own accounting, the most recently independent nation is, as far as I remember, is St. Kitts, which became independent in 1983. I don't think we've had another since then. And immediately prior to that, Zimbabwe in 1980. And we see now the advent of another era of the struggle for independence, better known as national liberation. Because I think we're not talking about independence so much for Puerto Rico as we're talking about the national liberation of Puerto Rico. I don't think we're talking so much about the independence of Southern Africa as much as we're talking about the national liberation of South Africa and Southern Africa. And those are fundamentally new definitions, because we're not dealing simply with the formal colonial structures. We are dealing with a new historic moment in which just the transfer of political authority on the internal front is not going to be adequate. I mentioned the case of Puerto Rico, and here I think if we are involved in issues concerning women, we cannot help but note the disaster that has been the record of Puerto Rico since 1898 and continuing today. One of my students who comes from a Puerto Rican family who belongs to the statehood party engaged me in the debate about whether Puerto Rico should have a commonwealth status, whether it should have become independent, or whether it should remain a state. And I told him, as far as I understand, the debate continues in Puerto Rico, and that's part of the reason why the issue took a while to go back on the United Nations agenda, because there are sizable sections of the population who are agitating for each of those different status. But for me, a very simple measurement of whether or not Puerto Rican independence is necessary can be seen if we look at the issue of women and food in Puerto Rico. That 68% of the Puerto Rican population lives on food stamps is an indication that the current status is non-viable. That the Puerto Rican female is subjected to unemployment in the first instance. And the pervasive use of land and water by the pharmaceutical industry in Puerto Rico, such that large incidences of disease related from these drugs are now prevalent in Puerto Rican society is also another indicator. And recently, I think it was last year, you would have heard about what is happening to the children, that children as young as 6 years old, female children, were having mature breasts the size of teenagers and young adults. And this was because of the high level of chemicals in the food, particularly, I was told, in chicken. And it's a dumping ground, just as is the case recently we heard that the nuclear industry here had sought dumping grounds in Haiti and in Sierra Leone. So that to the extent that these areas remain open for the exploits of multinational corporations or military programs, I think the continuing revolution for the improvement in conditions of women, that continues. Certainly after 1945, a new arrangement was put in place, but I'm arguing also that at this moment, as we turn the corner towards the 1990s, the arrangement is falling down. It is collapsed in many ways. No longer, for example, is Western Europe and Japan, for that matter, under the hegemony of the United States. No longer. And you would recall when the U.S. sought to put missiles on the soil of England and West Germany, it was European women who came out and fought against the nuclear policy of their countries. It's European women, in fact, who have been in the forefront of the peace movement in Europe. The arrangement is also being affected by the rise of some of the hitherto colonial states, like the OPEC countries. Not only are they able to amass large volumes of wealth from their natural resources, but they're able to aggressively compete on the international financial market, investing in London, in Europe as a whole, and in the United States, and giving stiff competition to the traditional avenues of financial power. In fact, one of the products of this period has been the production of a new elite, a new black elite in Africa and in the Caribbean. And within that, we have seen women as part of that and what their role has been vis-a-vis the struggle for equality and justice and democracy. I think that is part of what our own work in the last 10 years and in the next 10 years needs to rigorously analyze, that it is not enough just to be representative of a nation. And yes, there is a lot of pride in the fact that we can see women ministers and we can see black women holding high posts. But we need to analyze the content of their representation, the content of their production when they hold political power. In fact, while all of this has been going on, I argue that the major product of the last 40 years, when the US assumed world domination and so many new forces came to the forefront, was an increase in poverty. And again, I think the record has shown that in the preparatory work for the decade. The most telling statement about that increased poverty has been the debt, the foreign debt, which now stands, according to European sources, at 800 to 1,000 billion. And I cannot conceive that figure easily. I come from a place where there are just 100,000 of us. And I was reading in the Smithsonian magazine of a few months ago that a teacher was in an engineering class, in fact, No, it was new methods of teaching. He was trying to get his students to understand a million. This is in college. And to understand a million, he asked them to pop popcorn and to pop 1 million grains of popcorn and sit there and watch it fall and count the million so we can get a sense of the magnitude of what we're talking about. So for example, the Caribbean has a debt of $800 million. Now, that is two or three times the average budget of some of the most well-to-do countries. And the question is, how has that debt come about? And who does it affect most? Who is the most liable persons or constituencies for the debt? By far it is women and children. There is no doubt, particularly with the research coming out of Latin America, where the debt is being most popularized, but I argue that it is equally devastating in Africa. And those who, in fact, the debt was accumulated at the expense of women and children, and it is now going to be paid, if it is going to be paid at all, at the expense of women and children already. And thus we see and we hear different voices, such as the meeting in Havana earlier this year, such as Alan Garcia in Peru, and many non-governmental sources insisting that if developing countries are now going to be asked to repay a debt, that it is going to be at the expense of social and economic progress, mainly of women and children. The overthrow of the Duvalier regime in Haiti in earlier part of this year, February 7th, in a way signaled many things which I think may not have been reported in the media. Yes, it was the culmination of a long and treacherous struggle. Treacherous because, remember, Haiti won its independence from France in 1804, the first black nation in the Western Hemisphere. And it was compromised by successive leadership, not least of which was the Duvalier regime. But the meaning of the overthrow of the Duvalier regime in Haiti meant that the arrangements of the post-World War II period that somehow had been left secure were no longer secure. So that while there were revolutionary movements